Hello and welcome again to Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshenworks. I'm Diane Finkhausen, and today we're exploring how nature's own ecosystems are revolutionizing innovation and safety technology. Our guest, Alan Buchholz, embodies this ecosystemic approach with over 27 years of R&D experience. He's pioneered biomimicry-based solutions that have transformed military and civilian protection systems. As a visionary who's led over 140 R&D projects and holds 18 patents, Alan demonstrates how observing natural ecosystems from woodpecker skulls to whale echolocation can solve our most complex engineering challenges. His current doctoral work on helmet innovation using shape and resonance principles shows us how ecosystemic thinking isn't just changing individual projects, but entire approaches to human safety and performance. Alan, welcome to Ecosystemic Futures.
Yeah, thank you, Diane. Well, thank you for having me, and hello to you.
Great to have you here. I am so excited about this conversation. There's so much that we can cover here, but really, just to kick things off, you have been leading innovation for close to three decades now. Can you maybe help our listeners understand what initially sparked your interest in product development and how that path has led to you founding your own company and this area of exploration?
Yeah, sure. Well, I've always been passionate about research and development. I like to invent things. So actually, my dad was a master mechanic. So that's the highest level of mechanics. And he happened to have a lot of responsibilities with equipment. And when I was young, he used to bring me with me, make me watch. And I used to try to help him. And he would ask me questions, how would we fix this and everything. So I've always been passionate about the research and development. Yeah, for basically all my life. Yeah.
I love that. I love stories where parents really ignite the creative needs of their children, kind of bring them along. We've had a number of conversations, Alan, leading into this one. And you've mentioned that creating a unique R&D methodology that blends TRL and stage gate models. You've talked about how you approach R&D methodology that blends TRL and stage gate models. How does your system accelerate innovation, and how are you deciding what's worth pursuing? You have a multitude of arenas that you have worked in and that you could pursue. How do you prioritize where you focus your time?
Well, first of all, I've been doing this 27 years, and that's all I do is research and development. So I got quite good at it. And what difference me from maybe other people that just do pure research is I have the entrepreneurship element integrated into it. So most people don't understand that the money has to be involved. Well, most people understand, but a lot of the research, that's not the priority. So for me, everything has got to be the package deal. So you're looking local and global at the same time. So globally, you need the money. You need to make sure that things are going to be done with a way to attract people that are going to invest in your products. And then after that, there's the pure R&D element. The pure R&D element, well, you have to be able to gauge where you're going. The first thing I did was I came up with a type of chart that identifies the level of difficulty. Most people, when they come into an R&D project, they go, let's wing it. I'm going to do this. Well, let's start off by saying how difficult paper pin for putting paper together, or is it a nuclear bomb? I mean, so one is extremely easy to do in R&D, and the other one is extremely hard, and it's a big team, and it's a lot more money and effort. So R&D comes down to effort. How much effort do I need to put? And then from there, you rate it. So I came up with a chart from 1 to 7, so 1 being very easy to 7 being extremely difficult. So, and then after that, well, then you have to monitor it. So you got to monitor, and not only monitor your R&D, but also your monetary elements. So it's actually a package deal. So that's where TRL, technology readiness levels, come. So you like that, you know where you're going. Stage gate as well. I actually met Robert J. Cooper himself and took a course, saw him for many, many years before. I had many books of him from him. And then when I saw him, I made him sign my book. And then I told him that I used TRL as well as a stage gate. And he thought it was excellent when I had supper with him. So I combined these three things, the TRL to monitor where you, you know, where you are. I do the stage gate, go, no go within each gate to make sure that you're going in the right direction. I do this with my eyes closed. And I start off by seeing the level of difficulty that the project is. And I've helped other companies do that, because if I tell you this and you go, oh, that's a great idea. That makes a lot of sense. But how do I make this happen? So there's a lot of criteria how to do that. And then put a lot of imagination how to improve the R&D process. So when I work with government, I made a protocol. The problem when you do brainstorms, when you start off with a project, everybody's conservative. Nobody wants to make themselves look like a fool. It's like, so they're not going to come up with these really crazy ideas, right? Audacious ideas. They're going to be conservative, right? So how do you break that pattern? Well, I made a system. Is you have three-phase brainstorming. The first phase is you don't let them think. You go around the table and you say, first of all, the rule is no criticism allowed. Second of all, what we're going to do is you're going to come up with, so here's the problem. So we go over the problem statement that in detail, and we before we do the brainstorm, we really go over that so it's clear for everybody. And now, okay, so forget about the seriousness. Let's go to fun. I want you to come up with a solution, and you have to say it in 1 to 3 words, okay? And it has to be instant. So you go around the table, okay, you. And they're like, no, you say it. And if you can't say it, you say Star Trek. You say Star. I don't care what you say, but you say something. So then they go around the table, and then it's all gibberish. And then after that, it starts focusing. And then after that, it starts being really interesting. And then what you do is you have somebody on the board that writes all these things down. And the next thing you know, you have like 200 go away, come back. Okay, let's continue now. We eliminate the complete foolish ones. And there's a few, but there's some really good stuff left. And then after that, you elaborate that. No criticism allowed, right? And because the other guy next door is going to say, oh, that's such a stupid idea. No criticism allowed. And I make sure that I go wrong. And usually most people, they're good at that, but they won't criticize once they're told. I deal a lot with the military, so it's by the book. So, and then after that, once this is done, you really end up with some really good ideas. And then what you do is you criticism not only allowed, but it's mandatory. So you criticize everything, why it would work, why it would not work. And you already changed the mentality. So people are already thinking that, okay, this is how I'm going to make things work, instead of being incremental and really, really same old, same old.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You have to get people out of their comfort zone, right? And those kind of brainstorming approaches will really, I think, kind of ignite their freedom to operate, right, in the creative process. So that makes a lot of sense. You mentioned, I know it was just an example for somewhat hyperbole, but it's quite timely. You mentioned nuclear bombs, right, a moment ago, which is kind of a timely subject. And I know that another timely subject is NATO, but I know that you've supported NATO in the past, right, and various agencies, as you mentioned. How do you, and I myself do a lot of work with aerospace leaders in the aerospace sector, if you will, and the balance between innovation and brainstorming and imagining kind of the impossible missions with safety and excellence and engineering excellence. What is your approach to building high performing innovation teams? How do you balance the focus, the safety, the security, and the innovation with those teams that who operate under very high standards of not only confidentiality and security, but performance excellence?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yes, it's not the easiest thing in the world, but I try again. I'm a global local guy, so I always look at what I'm doing in front of me and at the same time all around me. What's important for my team is definitely knowledge and performance. That's one thing. But 50% of my criteria is actually attitude and how you fit in the team. I've had some teams that were awesome, because the synergy was there. So, and unfortunately, if you break the synergy, and there's multiple ways you could do this. One is being dominant. Two is not letting everybody else give their two. Unfortunately, I'll fire you. I'll get you out of the team. I won't keep you. I rather keep everybody harmonized than one champion that's dominant and everybody else is being stepped on. So it has to be harmonized. And that's really more important than people realize. Not easy in government because all kinds of reasons, but you have to really, and of course you try to put the dominant guy back in his place. And like I said, while we're working with military, so sometimes it's not easy, but there are ways to do that. And then you got to be a true leader and a strong person. And you have to understand psychology. One of my things I did in college was I actually did psychology. So that helps me to deal with people. And I was a national coach too. So that also helps me. But yeah, so it's really about harmony. I think that's probably the most important thing in a team. It's equally important as knowledge and performance. And usually I have a tendency to take the people that are really good. I was a bodyguard in my, like I say in my previous life, but I don't know, about 15 years ago, I needed extra cash and I well. And I was quite through the grapevine. I ended up with an elite company of bodyguarding, and we had all kinds of famous people and everything. But it allowed me to smell out people and to see how they are and to interact with them and go a little further than the nonverbal. So my team in R&D is well, one, you have to, as a true leader, you have to take control. You cannot let them run you. You run them. But you know what they say, right? If it's a team, okay, and it works, it's a team effort. But if it doesn't work, it's your fault. You, the leader. Right. So it's all on your shoulders. So you got to be diplomatic. You got to be kind. You got to be empowerment. You got to do all kinds of things to make that team harmonize. And you got to take control. And you got to take control in a very diplomatic way. And you can't squish the other people, because you want those creative juices to flow. And that doesn't work with hardship. It works with empowerment. And the military are just awesome with that when it flows. So I've learned from some really nice colonels that I tell you, and some generals. I mean, these guys, empowerment, phew. So yeah, we go with that. My biggest strength I felt in my career was I had new one. My idea was not as good as their idea. And at the end, which one has the better idea, and to take that good idea. So it can't be all about you. It's about the team. So it's about the team for the whole time until things go wrong and it's your fault.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And our listeners, a lot of innovators in our audience. So they will get this and understand and empathize with the challenges of maintaining that balance and pushing the conversation forward. Good and light and contention, we like to think of it
as. So just to let you know, in my career, I really had a good reputation. And at the end, the governments were giving us grants, and I would easily have $1 million grant. They only give that to the companies that had previously shown that they really know what they're doing. So I really, really enjoyed the R&D part, and I really got good at the R&D part. But what people don't understand is there are some projects that's just they're going to fail. So there is the 27 most common reasons why companies fail. And the number one is there's no need for market. I mean, if you don't work, if you're not human centered, I'm human centered. I work with the end user hand to hand from the beginning to the end. But not only that, and that's not always easy, because sometimes they have no idea what they want. Okay. But you have to make sure that there is a need and a want. Need, but there could be no want. A perfect example, there was a company that, without naming this company, they're making a composite engine and they approached GM. They said, GM, it's lighter, it's this, that's going to be great. They're going to love it. So they went to GM with their composite engine. It was a great engine. They worked a lot. Innovation was high. And to GM, do you want it? And they said, no. And they said, why? Well, we have to redesign the whole front end. We don't want to do that. So there was a need, but there was no want.
Right. Yeah, no, great points. That's an entrepreneur's trap, right? There are so many stories out there of the great ideas that just never got past go for the same reasons.
And the second reason why startups fail is the wrong team. So the team is, that would be the third. I think it's no running out of money is the second. Third is the wrong team. But anyways, the team is really, really important.
Oxygen. Yeah. You need that oxygen to keep things rolling for sure. Cash flow is just critical, but I'd love to, what fascinates me so much about your work, talk about having some humility in the innovation process and learning from the best ideas out there. You have perfected a journey that has been inspired by biomimicry. You have so many beautiful examples where your work is informed by nature. And I'd love to, if we could just kind of dive into that portfolio and what took you there and some of your practice. How are you applying the principles learned from nature to your innovation practice, if you will?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, back to my childhood, I guess it does influence us. We moved 27 times in my life, and my father was always in fields. He was doing dams. He was doing railroad tracks. So we were in the forest, and I didn't even see a TV or radio until I was like 10 years old. So I was in the woods, and it's funny, if you're actually able to do that, you really take time to observe things in the forest or in the woods. And I had done that, and it fascinated me, and your mind slows down, and it's not like the electronic, and you see really a lot of what people today don't see because they're on a fast track. So for me, I believed in nature, and I had studied nature. My family, they don't do this anymore, but they knew every plant and they knew every tree and they knew how to do everything in the woods. And my dad, he was a great hunter. Okay. We lived off wild meat. Until 10 years old, we never went to the store. So we go in the woods and we never got lost. And he had a compass, and he, even without the compass, we didn't get lost. He showed me that. So when I was young, so biomimicry for me is, well, for people that don't know what biomimicry is you look at nature, systems, elements, processes, and then you try to understand them. That's not the easy part. That's the hard part. Try to understand them, because most people think they do, but they don't. You don't know what you don't know. And then from there, if you're quite good at the high powers of observation and you're actually able to do that, then you understand some of it, and then you try to make it into a man-made product. So that's what I did. So I had done this. I try to do this in every project, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's just or at a minor level, and some it's at a high level. So some of the projects, let's just go over some of them. Exoskeletons was one of the things I had done, and for me, I believed in looking how we could make the human body more performance, and I had broken it down. So yes, I want the human to run faster, but at first I want the human to be comfortable with what he has. So I looked at the military with the weight they were carrying. Actually, my master's is on that. So I know quite a lot about load carriage. And so it was a lot of problems with injuries and all kinds of things. It was just performance. So how can we help the soldier carry that weight more effectively? And so what I did is I looked at obese people. Why did I do this? Because I said, wait a second, weight is weight, and whatever they're carrying, it goes on the body, and obese people are carrying extra weight like the soldiers, but instead of having ammunition or whatever, it's actually fat, or, you know, grease, all kinds of fat cells. And so I said, okay, let's look at that. So I had done a big study on this. I had looked at a lot of people that were obese, and some were bedridden, and when did they stop being bedridden, at what weight and everything. And then in reverse, I saw some of these people that were in the 500-600 pounds, and they were trying to lose weight, and then I want to see if they were mobile. So a 600-pound person is actually carrying 400 pounds of extra weight, because their normal weight should have been, say, 180 or something like that. So 400 and something. So that's interesting. You're carrying 400 and something. And I was working with SOFTs. I was Special Operations Command, one of my biggest clients. So I was dealing with these guys, and 200 pounds. I mean, they could probably put on their back 200 pounds, but they just couldn't walk properly, and never mind about running. So it was very difficult. And so I'm like, well, they can't even put 200 pounds. And the other guy over here, he's not an athlete. He's able to carry 400 pounds. What's going on? So it came down to putting the weight in the right place makes you actually more performance, right? So I looked at the soft guys and I went to the gym with them and I saw them picking up crazy amounts of weight. Even the Guinness World of Records, 5,000 pounds. Look it up. It's crazy. It's a Canadian guy. He just lifts weight like this. It's like, what? So when I'm looking at soft guys, and they're not in these type of weights, but they're certainly in high level weights. They were lifting, bench pressing easily 500 pounds. Go ahead. So
this was for the exoskeleton work.
Yeah. So there's a lot of research that was behind it. So I had done that. And then I said, okay, so people that have excess weight are not able to pick up this weight, but they're able to walk. But the special forces guys, they're able to pick up these incredible amount of weights, but they can't put a backpack that's 200 pounds. So, what's going on here? It's really obviously it's clear that it's you put weight in the right place. It's all about equilibrium. So we're bipeds and you have to put weight in the right place. So then I said, how can I transfer the weight in the right place? And the human bodies, we have agonist and antagonist group muscles and we actually take a break when we actually walk. I'm a human factors expert. So I looked at the body we had a $1 million lab with all kinds of things. So we looked at the body like crazy. And it was clear that when you're wearing a backpack, your abdominals are always compressed. There's no break. So right away, that's a big problem. And then the second thing is that it's just the body is not meant, because what we do is when we walk, we actually fall down leaning forward as bipeds. And then our muscles recuperate this and we keep this in balance, equilibrium. So the abdominals always contract. You can't do that. So anyways, so I tried to do exoskeletons to redirect the load in the right place with mechanical levers. And that was the direction. So that was one of my main biomimicry projects, which I looked at nature, which is actually, I just looked at the human and how they do, so the hypothalamus with the thyroid gland, which a liver would put every ounce of, I forget the English name, but the technical name for fat cells. So they'll put that in everywhere around your body where it should to keep your equilibrium. It starts for the transverse plane and then it goes up and down. Mainly around that, and it really tries to equal it everywhere else, but that's how the body works. Yeah.
Well, so then did that exoskeleton work then lead to the work that you've been exploring with the helmet? I think the helmet work is also fascinating. And
And
some of the, basically the inspirations that you've taken from nature. So
yeah. Let me switch to that. So that's one of a big passion of mine. It really is. So I had started, my career had started with making anything that's blunt trauma protection that's so I was young and fresh and optimistic. So I started doing that and I had this development thing, innovation thing. So I actually got quite good at it. And it was a body, would go in the body. I even did martial art protection and I did all kinds of blunt trauma, anti-blunt trauma protection. So we really got good at it. We actually made the cover page of a magazine in 2003. So Law Enforcement Technology, and there was the cover page and it had a really nice article on our technology in the US. So we did that and I kept working and everything, but it was a very difficult domain because in law enforcement, there's budgets and then there's priorities. And that was really at the low end of the priority. And there was a lot of competition. So every time I go see clients, I want. Okay. You're going to buy it. Well, no, I can't buy it because I don't have the budget. So I ended up really having a lot of difficulty with making, I made okay money, but barely making it. So the blunt trauma, I got good at it. And then after that, I've done everything from footwear to handwear to helmets. But what really interested me was the helmet part. And why the helmet part? Well, I don't know if you're aware, but there's at least 2 million people every year in the U.S. that have TBI, traumatic brain injury. And a lot of those are children. So you got the construction, the labor, people that do all kinds of things. And then you got the military. You got a lot of domains. You got bikes. You got there's a lot of TBI. And to my surprise, even if you're wearing a helmet, some some people had TBI. And for me, it was the children as well, right? So that was how many children do, football or hockey or some type of sport. And so it's quite high up there, the children. I think it's 400,000 children a year are hospitalized for TBI.
It's very extensive. When I was at GE, we were partnered with the NFL on their head health initiative and really exploring a lot of really novel approaches to head health and helmet protections. I was fascinated with your work and the shape plus resonance equals protection, right? So this, a lot of what you have been exploring is some of the observations in nature that can inform better solutions for head protection, for TBI prevention. So maybe.
Okay. Let's go there. Let's go there.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Yeah, let's go there. So, but before going there, I absolutely have to talk about animals that inspired me. Okay. So years and years of experience and being quite good at the blunt trauma. So mitigation with low energy compared to bullets, it's low energy. And actually I was one of the top in the industry, if not the top, and worked on all kinds of things. And then because of my biomimicry things, I went and I did like everybody. But what was different with me is that I looked at it from a different angle. First of all, you have to understand those woodpeckers. Okay. Science is very clear. 600 to 1,200 G forces that they're hitting. Right. So from acceleration to deacceleration to complete stop, those G forces, 600 to 1,200. That's clear. Literature is clear on that. Now, us humans, we start having mild TBI at 100 Gs, okay? Mm-hmm. And we will not survive 300-400 Gs. We will not survive it. We're dead. Or if we're not dead, it's not good. So how does it work? So wait a second. I'm thinking if their mitigation system would fail only once, that bird is dead. And we observe these birds through their whole life doing whatever they do, mating, chipping, eating. And there's no observable signs that these birds are injured and die after they're doing their pecking. They're not. But yet, the 600, even if they're not doing the 1,200, they're just doing the 600. The one failure of this mitigation system, I have a shock absorber in my car and it'll fail, right? One failure and is bird is dead, that means the species should be extinct, right? Because they all should die if it's one. So they never fail. They never, never fail. Their system never fails. So wait a second. So I really took the time I actually got obsessed with looking at all kinds of animals with bones and birds and everything. I even look at other species that even those that don't pick and everything. So it came down to me. It was clear after a while that Eureka was that when you have FEA, when you're doing FEA type of analysis, so software that helps you to reduce the weight of a part, and what you're doing is you're using the same material, and then through geometry, what you're trying to reduce is the weight of that. And now with generative AI, the ratio is even higher now. So they're able to reduce it by 80% where they were doing it with FEA before. And then FEA was 80% from what they were doing it just when they were just doing it by eye. And those new generative designs by FEA, they purely look organic. Every shape looks organic, right? So there's a certain load management. So dynamic and even static loads are being managed through FEA, through geometry. It's clear. It's clear that geometry is what does it. And that the geometry with certain. So you need to look at nature and you got to have a certain artistic eye to be able to see that. Okay. So one of another things that I had difficulty with was, I'm dyslexic and I have a tendency to see things as a big picture. And then I came up with the conclusion that people look at things through 1D, 2D, 3D, and 4D. So 1D is a book. I'm reading paper. That's what it is. Right? 2D is a painting, a picture. That's two dimensional. And 3D is I'm actually looking outside and seeing people walk in the trees and all that. 4D, nobody actually could see because it's actually the three dimensions plus what's inside. So a human body, a human person walking, and I could see those three dimensions while they're walking, but I cannot see what's inside. So people like myself, we can't really see inside, but we have a tendency, our brain, to try to look inside. So it's leaning forward too, but not really 100% there. So I started looking at things more through the eyes of an artist at the same time as a scientist, and I combined them. Say, for example, that I look at the U.S. Corps War Memorial in Washington, D.C. I don't know if you ever saw that statue. It's very famous. It's a bronze statue. It's 15 feet high. It's 16 feet wide. Okay. And Felix, the gentleman that designed it, took a picture, and he made a small little maquette. And then after that, he actually made the whole thing, right? I'll try to describe that in a book in a one-dimensional. Forget it. You're never going to get it. You don't know what you don't know. And some people will just not see the detail of how complex. And so the gentleman that did this, there's two individuals. So what was the Felix, the warden, and Horace Z were the architects. And anyway, so these had the ability in their mind from a picture to go and do a 16 wide and whatever, 32 feet high thing. And that is just, we don't see what we don't, we don't know what we don't know. And some people just don't see how things work. So FEA shows us that there is a lot of things happening with the shape. And what I came up with is the resonance. There's a resonance, and that resonance can be controlled, right? It could be controlled in many ways. So I looked at the woodpecker. I looked at the triangle beak, and I looked at the round head. I looked at the ram, which is a triangle actually as well, with their horns. And I looked at local and global. And then I worked a lot with sound. I looked at all the physics of sound that I could, for years and years and years, trying to understand what a node is, and what is an antinode, and how can I produce more nodes? Because in physics, nodes are all in equilibrium. And the nodes, if you go higher pitch, you'll just create more nodes, but they're actually all equally the same size, where the antinode is in between. And the resonance of products are done through their geometry, through their shape, through their silhouette. And the woodpecker, I came to the conclusion, when the woodpecker hits, it creates a kinetic. Well, first of all, energy is always when it's created, it's in motion. So kinetic energy starts in motion. It's already moving. So from there, what can I do to manage it? And I came to the conclusion that not only woodpeckers, but wrens and dolphins, they do echolocation. And it's funny how they come back with the echo. Their jaw, the shape of their jaw is hard wood. Same thing as those woodpeckers and those wrens. And it picks up. And then it goes into a fatty substance, which changes material. And then it goes and it finds itself to the ear. And they see in, not only that, this sound wave is actually quite in detail. So they actually see, they replicate what's in front of them. And that's very complex. It's like the U.S. Corps War Memorial. It's lots of shapes there. So this triangle thing in the front seems to really be important in multiple species and things happening. And the woodpecker has multiple mechanisms. So basically what you want to do with a mechanical wave, you know, transverse or whatever wave you want, okay, all the waves, what you want to do is you want to manage it. And what does that mean? Well, that means I want to redirect it. How do I do that? Through surfaces. People don't realize, but, you know, things can ricochet. A bullet hits the floor at a certain angle. It ricochets, right? Kinetic energy is already in motion. So if you put geometry that helps it to ricochet, influence it, motivate it to ricochet, that you could do that. So what you do is you redirect it. And then if there's no drag in your material and in sound, the speed, the velocity of sound and materials actually are really important. So the faster the velocity of sound and materials, the more the tendency will have to ricochet and actually go there. So when those, what you want to do is you want to fragment it. And you can do in your geometry, you'll notice that it's not smooth surfaces, but actually is smooth, not smooth, smooth, not smooth. So if you start looking at a microscope, and I did, I looked at so many bones under a microscope and everything, I noticed that, wait a second, this is smooth, not smooth, smooth. So what you're doing is you're ricocheting, you're fragmenting. And if you're really good, and how does that work with circles, is you're breaking it down into two, and you try to break that wave into multiple pieces, two or thousands of pieces, and then you redirect it back at itself to annul it or cancel it out, right? So if you look at canceling technology, which exists in sound things, that's something that you have to start looking at into these things. Go ahead, Diane.
So yeah, no, this is fascinating. So Alan, listening to you, I'm thinking there are multitudes of I guess lessons or principles in nature that you could study, right? So how do you, when you're looking at natural systems, how do you decide which natural systems, like echolocation or impact resistance, which natural systems you want to study in order to take inspiration for your innovation priorities? How do you make that selection?
Well, that's a great question. That's a great question. So you got to have high powers of observation. You got to be a researcher. You got to be patient. And you really have to take the time to study these things. And you're trying to be as global as you can at first, and you try to go here, left, right, and then you focus, and then you focus, and then you focus, and then, you know, it's a funnel, and at the end, you're going where you want to go. So at first, you really have to take the time to explore. So there's a lot of techniques now with AI to help you do that. At the end of the day, you really have to do your homework. You got to be a researcher, and you got to be, it took me at least 5 years. I've been 27 years I've been doing this, and the woodpecker thing and the bone thing, I've been doing for at least 25 years. Right. And so it took me 5 years just to really understand which one I should focus on. And then once you find those things, you got to take the time to study, because I tell you, a lot of these people out there, they think they know, but they don't know. And they say, oh, yeah, it's this, it's that. And then they go and they say the shock absorber thing, because our cars all have shock absorber and we all think it's a shock absorber, but nature doesn't use shock absorbers. And yes, so let's talk the real words. So acceleration and deceleration. And so yes, you must decelerate the wave. And yes, there are ways to do that. But just don't focus on deceleration. And that's what everybody does. 99% deceleration. So no. I want to accelerate that wave so I could fragment after. So yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. You mentioned this a moment ago, but I would like to double click on that, because it basically innovation and change are accelerating, right? And converging. And we're seeing just a renaissance of innovation and change in society, industry, and technology. And you touched upon AI just very briefly a moment ago. In your experience, what emerging technologies like AI, nanotechnology, advanced materials, do you think are going to best complement or perhaps take advantage of biomimicry and solving tomorrow's protection challenges or tomorrow's innovation landscape, if you will?
Well, definitely AI. I'm for AI. I know some people are against it and everything, but I really like AI. I have 6 AIs I use, and I'm getting better at it. I understand how they think and how they work. And then I think now things are going so quick, so fast, and we have such, it's not just having access to things, because we always had access to things, but now we're finding better ways to actually be able to, within the fog, to focus on where you have to go. And I think it's not just with AI. I work with my AI. I start thinking like my AI, and she can't stop complimenting me, because I'm really going, we're working in synergy. It was like with my team before, but now it's with my, I don't know. That's me, but it really, it's easier to focus now. And I don't care how advanced you are. Nature is the kingpin there. Nature has done it better and for longer. And I think it's just the beginning. I think it's just the beginning, because we're we barely understood these things. I mean, I heard so many scientists, and I love all you scientists. So don't get mad at me, but I heard so many scientists telling me about the woodpecker thing, and then I've been doing it for a long time, and I tell you, I went far in that study, very far. I would physically go in the field and look at these things, and I think innovation now is just going to go skyrocket. It's exciting. It's really exciting.
I couldn't agree with you more. Actually, you started to, I think, go here, but you've spent decades translating nature solutions into human applications very effectively. If you could give one piece of advice to young innovators about how to think chemically and to be informed by the masterpieces of nature, what would that advice be for our young innovators?
Yeah. Well, first of all, take a deep breath and relax. Okay. Then after that, take the time to not have bias in your observation. Really take the time to understand what is happening. Nature does system among systems. Okay. And then everybody, I've seen it so many times, they see the surface of the systems, but they don't go see the deep parts of the system. So take the time and go with logic. A perfect example. Why do us as humans, as a species, have hair? Right? You ask people that and they all say, oh, it's because it's the cold. Well, I looked at nature and I looked at every species that is in a cold environment. And what is a cold environment? You're talking 42 to 32 and below that is extremely cold. But these species, when they protect their head, they protect their arms, their legs, they protect everything. So if you're just going to protect your head, no, it's not for the cold. No. It's not going to protect just for the cold because we're born naked. And I tell you, I'll make you walk outside at 40 degrees. It's not frozen yet, but you're not going to last too long. Actually, you won't even live too long. But on the contrary, we're excellent with hot temperatures. And what's on top of us is the sun. And where does it hit you the most? On your head. So for me, hair is to protect you from the sun. And it goes over your shoulders, your back, and everything. So nature did that. So yeah, we like it short, but back then maybe we had it long. And we were naked with long hair in drinking our pina colada in the sun. That's what we did. We're no cold. Yes, human being did not adapt to the cold. It killed animals and it developed clothes. But physically, anatomically, whatever, we are not meant for the cold.
Yep.
That's biomimicry. That's observing things come in package deal. If the package deal doesn't work, your diagnostic, your hypothesis is wrong.
Yep. I'm a Midwest girl moved to the South. So I am living that example. I'm all about the warmer weather. So with you on
there, you go.
If we look forward, maybe 10, 20 years, couple decades, how do you envision the relationship between human technology and natural ecosystems evolving? Are we moving more towards truly symbiotic innovation? Do you think that we're going to find a natural flow between nature's systems and human systems?
Well, honestly, I don't know. It's hard for me to tell because on one part, you can't get out of nature. It's just a reality. And there's a biological basic thing that you need. You need to eat, you need to drink, you need to sleep. And we think we're really advanced. And yes, so we are advanced in certain things. But I tell you, nature, we haven't discovered all our secrets. And I really hope so. I really hope so that we focus more on nature and go back to natural things. And I think it could be a symbiotic relationship. And I think it's all about being more conscious of nature. I think people should do that. No, take the time to go in the woods and look at, people thought I was nuts. I would stare at water for hours and just trying to look and try and understand what's going on. And maybe I still don't understand. But, you know, you got to take the time to smell the roses and just relax. You have to if you want to learn from nature. But, you know, AI, I hope is going to help us. But I'm an optimistic guy by nature.
I share your optimism and your fandom for AI. I use it every day, all day. So just understanding what tools and what lessons to apply to which applications and outcomes, that's half the battle right there. And I like the advice to get out there in nature. And if not an educational experience, certainly will be a nice way to unplug from the kind of the digital, experience that we all are living today, every day. But yeah, I think nature is just a master class on how systems evolve and in symbiotic and in interesting ways. And we probably have a lot that we could still learn and apply to our own set of complex challenges. So I love the work that you've done and hope that our listeners will continue to follow the amazing work that you're doing. We'll encourage them to do that and we'll share some of the information that you've provided in the show notes so it's easier for them to follow your work, Alan. But thank you for sharing some of your journey and your experience and your perspective, your worldview with our folks. I know a lot of our listeners are innovators, they're futurists, they're kind of market makers. And so they're looking for that toolkit and those where they can find those master classes on how to shape and advocate change.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much. Just on a final note, I think if there's some area of focus that people should do is two, imagination and vision. And they're not the same, right? Imagination is the ability to come up with something new, something different. And vision is to see things that are going to be done without physically seeing them at first. So you must try to explore and try to nurture your imagination and your vision. And I think imagination is probably one of the most important one. And that is, you got to be curious. So you got to be curious. And then you got to say, what if, and go with the what ifs everywhere, every part of the day, if you can. What if this, I understand you got to stay focused and don't hit the car in front when you're driving, but you know, what if this could be done? And what if this could, that's part of the, one of the exercises. Try to see the small things and try to do it locally and globally at the same time. When you drive a car, you look in front and looking back, in front, looking back. Okay. Same thing. Focus on everything locally and globally. Big picture while understanding the small things at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that resonates. We in this series, we explore ecosystemic systems and innovation, and really necessarily really by design, we're looking at systems and systems of systems, right? It's the interconnectedness of the details and the big picture and that interplay. So your advice will resonate with our listeners, I know. And really, Alan, your work just beautifully illustrates how ecosystemic thinking, drawing from nature's $3.8 billion per years of R&D, is reshaping innovation across industries, from military applications to civilian safety. You have and continue to show us how biomimicry creates not just better products, but entirely new paradigms for protection and performance. So, Alan, thank you again for joining us today, sharing these insights into how natural ecosystems are informing our technological futures. And everyone out there, please subscribe to Ecosystemic Futures on Apple Podcasts or your favorite platform and learn more about our work at shoshimworks.com. Until next time, keep exploring how nature's wisdom can guide our innovation ecosystems. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Alan.
Thank you, Diane.